I'm going to mention this now because I know I'm going to forget, but I'll mention it again just in case I forgot to tell you this time now. But a couple of people have asked me about if everything we've done, the seminars and the keynote addresses, are going to be on the website. The answer is yes, they are. And if you would like, you can take down the website to access them. It's www.citynetphilly.org. So it's all one word, citynetphilly.org. And so just give us a couple of weeks before, you know, you check out the website and get the get all that information. So I just wanted to let you know that now. And I'll probably say it again. Okay. With that being said, let me start off with the first question. Any of you all can just jump in. How do you get people to be serious about volunteering to begin with? How do you get people serious about volunteering to begin with? Anybody want to jump in?
You can't.
Next question.
getting volunteers is like pulling teeth. I think when people are appropriately equipped for a specific ministry task, they'll do it. The basic premise is to pray that God would do the tugging and pulling of people's hearts. We can't make people volunteer, but we can make ministry user-friendly, make the tasks specific, convenient, and measurable for people so that they see how it can fit in with the other demands of their life, and develop ways where they can be apprentices and observe this type of ministry in action, whatever it is.
Okay.
But people mostly will volunteer to work in non-risky situations, baking cookies or cakes to raise money, but not where evangelism really matters, working with at-risk groups, coming alongside of people who are broken or brokenhearted. That really requires the work of the Holy Spirit.
Okay. Anyone else want to jump in on that question? Let's take the next question. How do you keep, and this might tie in a little bit, how do you keep from being cynical toward people who call our church for financial help, et cetera, especially when they keep returning? So this sounds like a diaconal needs question. So would anybody like to take that?
Okay. I'm going to pull my chair up a little. Yeah. I believe churches need to establish policies of how much and how far they're going to work with a particular family. It's really a matter of how much do you want to love and how far are you going to go? I know Tim Keller says in his book, Ministry of Mercy, that we should give until it hurts, because that's what Jesus did. But on the other hand, we don't want to develop dependency. Now, my philosophy of ministry is not to work harder than the people coming for help, but to empower them as much as we are able to help them to network the social service system and to be able to take small successful steps into helping themselves.
Okay.
But I can't do anything about the cynical part because I'm a cynic. I think when you're working in mercy ministry, it's just normal that we should be cynical and not trust others.
Okay. The next question I'm going to direct to Dr. Fuller, because it's a question that deals with seniors. Here's the question. How do you work with seniors who have the attitude that they have done their time when you try to encourage them to get involved and share their wisdom and experience? And I want to add on a little bit to this, not senior in the sense of age, but senior in the sense of, you know, they've worked at a place for a certain period of time, let's say, in a certain person's case, I know 35 years, and they say, you know, I've done my time, I've reached the age, I want to, you know, live my life on easy street. I want to, you know, do that sort of thing, and I just really am done with doing all that kind of stuff.
The question, I guess, has to do with retirement. We have in the United States a retirement age of 65. Now, by the time some of you youngest people that are here get to that age, it's going to be about 78, because you're going to be paying for the rest of the people that are here. But it's 65 because von Bismarck set that in Germany 150 years ago. But I'm not sure in the Bible where there is a Bible verse that says at a certain age you retire from Christian service. There may be such a passage. I'm not aware of it. And I know when the priests got older, they did different things, but they still served. So it may be that you're tired of being an elder, and I could certainly understand that. But you should therefore do something else. And shut-ins are called to minister. Now, I guess when you become mentally incapacitated, you may no longer be called to serve because you don't understand it. But in the manual that we did, there's an example in the beginning of a woman that was a shut-in, and she was bedridden. And she was really disappointed, according to the member of our church who knew her. She was disappointed because she said, I can't do anything for Jesus. I just lie here in bed all day. So she developed a ministry to telemarketers. And she would pray that they would call her. And when they did, she would ask them, she'd say, I don't need siding for my house, but do you know about Jesus? And then she would engage them in conversation and then send them gospel tracts and such things. There's no retirement from Christian service. You don't serve up to a point and then quit. You may change your direction, change your service, but the Old Testament, as I mentioned, is very simple. God delivered us from Egypt, and therefore we serve him. And the New Testament is the same. Jesus saved us from sin, and therefore we serve him, and that never changes. You don't get away from that. There's no retirement. You have some very serious questions to ask yourself about your own understanding of salvation if you think you retire from Christian service.
Okay. This is a question I'm going to direct to all the way on the end, because I think this deals with something that I'm not familiar with. The question is this, are there any grants, or are there any financial avenues or grants or things of that nature to support making a church ADA compliant? We have a wheelbound member who is not able to come down the stairs to the fellowship room. So they're asking if there are any grants or other financial ways to make a church compliant. Okay, well then,
I'll give my stab and then Stephanie can pick up the rest.
Okay.
I'm not sure why you picked on me though.
Well, I apologize, but you know, I tried.
I know for employment, if you employ someone who is physically disabled, or let's say they have a hearing problem, or they need some type of a device and you employ them in the church, you can get grants to make it employable for that person. But I do not know of any grants that will make the building accessible. I think that has to be more within the church. I do know that a lot of churches in the Philadelphia area were snookered by a company that told them they should use, they should buy these lifts that are chair lifts that you get on the chair and they take you up and down the steps. But unfortunately for someone like myself, they don't do any good. So quite a few people were discouraged when they spent money in their church to do that, and it really couldn't help anyone who was in a wheelchair. So, but Stephanie probably knows more.
Yes, go ahead.
The Job Accommodation Network through the federal government does the advising about accommodations for workers and the means to pay for them.
Yes.
There are several foundations in the Philadelphia area that give to Christian organizations generously and graciously. But most of them that I know about specify that they will not give to a specific church or a specific denomination. They will give generally to Christian work. So I think the answer to that would be it would be very difficult to get money from a grant.
Okay. Stephanie?
I'm only aware of one particular organization that has a small grant. Then that's Johnny and Friends has a $2,500 matching grant, I think, that you can get, which will not help you very much towards an elevator or a lift, but is enough to help you towards an electronic door opener, you know, and things like that. So, and if you check with Johnny and Friends, they might be aware. I'm not sure who might have money either, but they would know if there is an organization that's out there that does more, you know, more than what they can do. And it's in terms of finding out specific information about that, you can just contact the Johnny and Friends office that's in Lancaster, or Gary and Joan Borton that are here in this area and at Johnny and Friends satellite office. So.
Okay, thank you. After the next question, I'm going to come down the stairs, so I'm going to feel like a talk show host. I'm going to come down the stairs, and I'm going to ask you to, if you have any questions for our panel, I'm just going to open the floor to you as well. So think about a question you would like to ask as I ask this next question. With porn so readily available to children via the internet, what are the lasting effects of exposure? How does one deal with pre-adolescent exposure, and how can it become addictive so that I guess it's that early or that young?
I guess that's my question. Tell me the first part again.
Okay,
Daniel.
Sure. With porn so readily available to children through the internet, what are the lasting effects of exposure? And how does one deal with pre-adolescent exposure?
Well, the lasting effects of exposure, I heard this recently. Someone said that children are great recorders of everything they see, but they're the worst interpreters of everything they see. And I think that's specifically true there. They're great recorders of something they see that they don't understand, that forms in their mind. And, of course, continued exposure just reinforces that. Isolated things like that have historically been true in many people's lives, but we've never had a day and time in which it was such an available thing that people are bombarded with over and over and over and over again. Now, I don't think we've seen the implication of that yet. I think we still have a groundswell and a barrage of things coming, impacting people in the next years that's going to show how devastating that is. But when a person does not have a place to go to talk about what they've seen and somebody to interpret it for them, that's when the danger is of returning over and over again and it lodging in your heart. So the thing we need to be doing in our churches is helping people have a place that's open to talk about that so that it becomes interpretable and people can put it in a context to unravel the power of it. It's okay. The secrecy of it is where the power is, and secrets destroy. So is that helpful?
Okay. Okay. Penny, you want to jump in on that in any way?
I think you did a great job.
Okay. I agree, but I just thought you might want to jump
I've
in.
Learned in marriage, you don't improve on what.
Oh, okay. Well, see. Well, that's a good thing for me to think about in the future, since I'm in a single status. Okay, it's your turn. Who has a question? Or else I'll just come back, go back up and ask some more.
I have a question. When you mentioned that women's prison ministries are sort of handled semi-separately.
Yes.
Can you give some basic highlights of where and how that's done in the city and in the region?
Well, in Philadelphia, in the county system, there's a separate women's prison, and there are women chaplains. There are male and female leaders who go inside that prison to conduct Bible studies or to do training programs. But in terms of reaching individual women who've been arrested and incarcerated, it's through the Riverside Correctional Facility. And the head chaplain there is a woman named Joanne, runs a New Hope for Women, an outside program. In terms of the institution itself, as far as aftercare is concerned, the network that I'm part of, the Kingdom Care Reentry Network, there are many churches and agencies in that network. There are about 65 partners, and many of them have capacity and services for women. I do have to comment, though, that of the prison population, serving women is more difficult because most often there are children involved and family issues that are complicating and oftentimes unique. And just in terms of the housing needs for people in transition who are coming home from prison, it's really difficult. So if anyone here, any church represented here, has a heart for serving women in that situation, there's a real crying need. And I just need to remind you, that's the fastest growing segment of the prison population, just because of everything that's going on with young women in our society.
Okay, who else has a question for our illustrious panel? Oh, let me come up there. Unless you want to. Go ahead.
I'm working with folks from just, you know, they're experiencing all different situations. People who are in prison, or people who can't hear, or people in the inner city where I'm just interacting with kids. And, you know, they're African American kids, and I go out with them, and they're nervous to be around me. They feel embarrassed. How do you break those barriers? How do you care for people where they're at? How do you break through that and be able to gain people's trust? What are some things that you do?
One of the things that we always suggest is to try to provide activities outside of the home, because most children, especially that are in broken homes or in the city environment, are longing to get out. And so it usually doesn't matter which it is, but if your activity is something, you know, that they know about or that they can be involved in. So sometimes it's knowing the age group of the kids, and then of course knowing what, you know, whether they like basketball, whether they like swimming, whether they like, you know, frisbee or however it is. But we have found that we've had up to 15 children at our house for dinner after school. We have a rule that we don't allow a child at our house unless we speak to their parent or guardian. But just in our neighborhood alone, there's probably 30 foster homes within 6-block or 8-block radius. And so we found that food is a big draw for all kids, of all ages, and music, you know, and really there are there's not a whole lot of cultural barriers with potato chips and, you know, things like that. So, you know, you just kind of have to choose your foods.
One of the things you mentioned was trust. And the only way to establish trust is to establish a relationship. And as, you know, with regular folks, it takes a while to develop trust. And if you're dealing with yourself and someone who before this is a stranger, it's going to take some time. So our availability with those who we want to develop a long-term relationship with is vital. And the thing you offer is some kind of hospitality. You know, coming to the table to do something together, whether it's involving food or games or something else that will just allow you to get to know the person better. I mean, that's true with kids and adults. But it's trust also, the hardest part is trusting God for the timetable, which we have no control over. But, you know, if you're doing the work because it's right and because you're honoring God with your obedience, then that's the most important thing.
Just to add to that too, probably more of the problems in your heart than it is in the children's hearts. Kids can have a difficult time sometimes, but I found most of the time that if you just love them for a little bit of time, they will get past who you are real quickly.
It's not just kids.
Right.
We minister in prison, and you have somebody that's like interacting with you very openly. This person seems like they're your best friend. You try to call them as soon as they get out, and they don't know you. They don't, you know, the wall goes right back up.
Mm-hmm.
I think if it's a large part is also race, and I think, you know, you have to go back to the Manny Ortiz mantra, you know, sit at the feet of the culture you're serving. And so it doesn't mean you have to become an expert or, you know, Shelby Still or you know, Cornel West on Afrocentricity and the history of African Americans dragged to America on this land and on and on and on. But I think one of the tools you can use, especially it seems like it's mostly in people of color of communities that you're serving, is also to sit at the feet of the culture you're serving and to learn a little bit. So even if it's just a little bit, you know, say, just use tools that shows interest in their humanity and in their culture. Oh, my wife and I are trying to cook collard greens tomorrow night. What's the best way you do it? I tried it and it didn't work. Do you use water or white vinegar or rice vinegar or whatever? And also be honest about who you are. I think be just very direct and say, look, I'm just, you know, a white boy from so-and-so doing this, trying to do this. These are, and share a little bit about your own journey so there's not this illusion of, you know, privilege or this life of, you know, the man, he had it easy, he's just here to help be the white savior, I'll take what he's giving me, give me the potato chips and I'll, like you said, I don't know you when you're out, but also showing a part of your journey and your struggle and your own humanity. I think if they see that and hear that, that could be an inroad too, but just be honest about what's there, the elephant in the room. You're Latino, I'm black. You're Latino, I'm white. And I don't know much, but I want to learn from you. So it's not just here, I'm giving. It's also like, I want to learn from you. What do you have to give? I remember there was this partnership between a very well-off church and an inner city, and the guy was sitting there saying, Ruth, we did this, and we fed the poor, and we gave them clothes, and we got over, and I said, oh, and what did you learn from them? And he was like, what could I learn from it? Like, the mother had, you know, five kids from six different husbands, men, and inner city, and just got off a crack. What can I learn from her? I was like, there's a lot you can learn from her. Did you give her a chance to teach you something? So I think that exchange.
Okay, let me just jump in for a second and just remind you, and we'll go on to the next question, about your evaluations. We really do take them seriously, and we want to make sure you fill them out before you leave. So make sure that you are pleased to do that. Now, the next question is kind of related to a previous question, but I do want to bring it up because it was addressed. How do you respond continually for requests for assistance from needy families, financial, over a couple of years without a change of heart of parents, which in result is creating dependency? So how do you respond to continually requests for assistance from needy families, particularly financial, over a couple of years without a change of heart?
Sometimes you just have to say no. In the name of Jesus. You know, there are enough social services out there that you can help someone navigate that system and help them obtain as much as is available and supplement what you can. You know, if, depending on the family that you're dealing with, you may not want to say no. You may want to labor, especially if, I mean, if you're dealing with families with children, you don't want to victimize someone who hasn't been victimized before. You know, if you say no, what's going to happen? I mean, there are a lot of intricacies involved. We surely don't want to incur long-term dependencies. And the more information we have about what's available in the community, what resources are there, all of this is going to help us make a wise decision.
Okay. A question, I think this relates to the church, but let me just raise it. How do you bring our specific needs of the congregation regarding sexual, HIV, financial topics that have remained behind the curtain? How to bring our specific needs of the congregation regarding sexual issues, HIV, financial topics that have remained behind the curtain? How do you do that?
I was Rob Reich, physician's assistant at Esperanza Health Center. He was so kind and generous, along with his beautiful bride, Esther, to come today. And he has a wonderful program that he does at Esperanza that goes into the churches. So I would like him to answer if possible.
I think one of the things that I feel blessed with is being at a church, and there's no perfect church, but there where there's a culture of transparency, and even in the leadership. And one of the things that I was blown away with our pastor Manny Ortiz is his transparency of his struggles. And I think if you promote if the church culture is one where we're all sinners, and that's a foundation, and then creating opportunities, whether it's a talk on HIV or a talk on homosexuality or forums and an openness, and maybe some individuals may want to speak about that, obviously, privately, but I think the church culture really does impact the opportunity that people who are struggling with those things can go and talk to someone. I appreciate what was mentioned here, too, that secret, you know, maintaining those things in secret is really part of what leads to being enslaved by some of those struggles. And so I think the church culture makes a big difference. And maybe, Ruth, if you want to add to that.
Can you tell a little bit about what you're doing, too? Not that this is a commercial.
Yeah. Something that we're still very much working on at Esperanza Health Center is trying to create better relationships with local churches and addressing health needs in the local churches in our area and other places. And if if your church is interested in a health talk about a specific topic, such as HIV, such as diabetes, such as high blood pressure, as Christian providers, we enjoy going and talking about those health topics, because there's a lot that the gospel talks about and how it transforms all of our lives. It transforms us relationally, it transforms us in our community, transforms the way we view our own health. So if you're interested in a topic like that, a health-related topic at your church, I'd be glad to talk to you afterwards. But that's something that we're in the infant stages of doing it at Esperanza.
Okay, I'm going to ask one more question from you all out there. So feel free to raise any questions that you have. Yes.
We've heard a lot today about the struggles and the trials and the grief that are brought about by the sins and crises. Many times here, and I'm sorry I couldn't attend more the seminars, but limited. But as myself being a church officer, and as you know, many others here today are in that same situation, you want to try to stop a crisis. But how do you diagnose these problems in the earliest possible way? I mean, trust, building trust with families, as mentioned, showing hospitality, I think Dave mentioned, so you can accelerate this process and get to know people, and people feel free to share with you. I mean, on one hand, you don't want to feel like you're over-probing in somebody's life. Good to just have a church where people know one another. But is there anything else that you can do to help us solve the problem before it gets to the crisis stage too often? You become aware of it then.
Certainly for church members, people who are in fellowship in the body, you'd want to get to know as many families in the church and develop trust right there so they'll be vulnerable enough to say that we are hurting, or to be close enough because one of their members is in a Bible study, and they'll share with others what they're struggling with, or how they're hurting, or what their needs are. I always say, let's anticipate the future so we can intercept it when it happens. So if we know what the needs are early on, we're in a better position to deal with them, to encourage the adults there to deal effectively themselves with their problems. If training is needed because someone isn't employed, for the church to provide that. For encouragement where it's needed, to provide that. If there's spousal abuse, to make sure that that's dealt with. If the wife in particular needs to be in a safe house or to remove herself from that abuse, you to make sure that that happens, because otherwise the entire family is destroyed. The more that we can communicate within the body and really know what's going on in the lives of our households, the better. And then, a lot of the crises will be prevented.
I think that one of the things that has always encouraged me to speak out about my sin in my life is when people share how God has forgiven them and restored them. And so I think that if the churches are more willing to bring in testimonies of people that have overcome homosexuality by, walking with Christ, or have overcome pornography issues, or, you know, if it's not, the church is supposed to be a hospital for sinners, but there's still a facade that it's really where the good people go, and it's where the people who don't have sin go. And Jesus, you know, he gave a lot of hope, and he sat with the sinners, and that's who we are. And I just think that that facade needs to be removed. And like we have in the ministry that we're involved in, we ask single moms and single dads to share their testimony about how God has brought them through different things in their lives. And many of the single moms and single dads in the ministry serve us and serve other people. And that encourages people to step out and say, I need help. So I think if there was more testimonies, maybe once every month, there should be a testimony of somebody.
Okay. Anyone else have any questions for the panel? And then I'm going to do something a little bit different.
Are there times when you're looking at either big society effects of certain problems that people have? I'm sure that Lynn does. There's sometimes when you work, as Lynn does, on policy on the upfront part of it, so that, let's say, the schools could actually be, it's not just the you know, maybe do a tutoring program, but we intervene in some way so that there there's effective education in the schools. And we don't just, you know, is there some kind of time when you engage the political process and or the civic process or the People's Assembly process to literally change what ends up with more of the problems down the line? If it's housing, do you consider different forms of taxation or whatever so that it's not how to subsist at the end of having done an intervention, but how to grow real vibrance and life in culture by interacting with policymakers? I know that Lynn does.
I encourage the people that we're working with to become better educated and follow through with specific agencies that can be advocates. I don't get involved in that because I want to empower those I'm working with. But it's important that I be knowledgeable about where they can access that information and where they can vote.
Can you share how you
vote? I think what Yuta may be referring to is if you truly believe that God is sovereign over the civic arena as he is over the church, you know that he's at work in these systems. And to be open, have your eyes on those issues, and to have people in your group or your church encouraged to put their expertise into those arenas as advocates. But I think probably the most important single thing is to try to understand what it's truly like to be that, quote, client, what life is really like for that person. And try to begin to see it from their eyes. And you begin to see that there are obstacles for them that are not obstacles for you. And you can help them navigate those, but you can also begin to address those things with the people in those systems if you have the opportunity. I'd like to actually connect it to a comment that the young man made up in the back. You need to be patient. These things took a long time to get in place. And it may take a long time to make a change at that arena, but at the same time, the demand for true justice for the lives of people that you serve requires that sometimes you stand up and address them. And I think God will honor that.
Thank
He always has.
Okay. For the sake of time, and since you all have been so wonderful to address our questions, and first of all, wonderful to stand up here and let us ask our questions, I want to give you all 30 seconds to say whatever you would like to say. And the clock starts to tick after I stop talking. So 30 seconds, anybody can say what they would like to say, starting down here, and just whatever. And if you would like to pass, you can feel free to do that.
I'm Rob Reich from Esperanza Health Center, and I guess what I have to say is I'm still learning a lot of what this is all about, and just really appreciate those who are doing this for a lot longer, so a lot to learn, not much to say.
Okay. My name is Steph Hubach. I'm with M&A Special Needs Ministries. I guess 30 seconds, whether you're doing disability ministry or any other form of mercy and justice ministry, I think respect-based relationships are essential to any kind of meaningful ministry. And if you think about it, they're really built on the pillars of grace in the image of God. And in grace, we identify with each other in our shared brokenness. And in the image of God, identify with each other in our shared value. And when you relate to people from that vantage point, it clicks. You know, I think that resonates with people. And I think God works through that.
I'm George Fuller. I used to work here at Westminster Seminary, and I want to remind you that these flags represent the alumni of Westminster Seminary and where they serve, and that allows me to suggest that many of them are engaged in the ministry of mercy, and I think it's helpful to remember that we're not in this alone. That we're in a church that's worldwide, and that there are churches around the corner, down the block, across the street, that are also engaged in the ministry of mercy.
My name is Lynn Crow. I was asked to participate to speak about prison ministry, and a significant transformation is taking place in the nature of prison ministry. It is now being focused more on what you are doing outside the prison than inside. So I believe the day is coming when every prison ministry is going to have to be providing aftercare services as well as providing inside the walls Bible study and evangelism. And I believe that for congregations who want to do that, the best way to do it is in a network, because each church can't provide all the things that people need. So by picking up the phone, you can get help with housing, with jobs, with substance abuse counseling, et cetera, if you're part of a committed network that will work together to provide support for men and women coming home from prison.
I'd like to just share words of a wonderful urban missionary poet, John Jaw Watson. Mercy on the wicked, that means you and I. Mercy on the broken, that means you and I. Lord, do not treat us as our sins deserve. In your great mercy, we are not consumed. God gives beauty for our ashes to both you and I. Lamentations 3:22-23 is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is his faithfulness.
I encourage you, because mercy ministry is difficult. I've been working at 10th Presbyterian Church for 20 years now, and trying to develop word and deed ministry together is like turning an ocean liner very quickly. You can't do it. But I've been encouraged that God is present, and God is doing the changing. I've had to go to the cross in repentance because I want my timetable to be for God to honor my timetable first. I've had to learn that while I'm praying that God would change other people, that I also have to learn how to love them. Mm-hmm. And those are things I don't want to do most of the time. But each day it brings me to the foot of the cross.
I don't have anything profound to say, but it just occurs to me as I look at the panel of people, all of our ministries have, we represent ministries that have been around for centuries. The widow, the poor, the disabled, the sexually broken, people with diseases, poverty, families in need and crisis. It's been with us. The New Testament church spoke to it. God spoke to Israel about how you're supposed to care for the widows, the orphans, and the strangers. So I don't know that our churches are going to eradicate any of these problems, but I think that we need to still allow mercy ministries to impact us, whether it's sexual, whether it's poverty, whether it's multiracial, multicultural ministries. We just need to be sensitive and just pray for our wisdom. That's something that's impacted me more and more, is I'm not, the wiser I get, the more humble I become and dependent on God.
That was Penny, my wife. I'm John Freeman at Harvest USA, and I guess the thing that I'm really passionate about these days, I think the gentleman at the end talked about it, is that mercy and compassion for people is something that, and transparency is something that comes from the top down. And as leaders, we've got to tell people that Jesus is for you in whatever pit that you're in, and work at strategies that do that verbally and non-verbally, and also communicate the message that we're not fragile here, which I think with the subtleties of these hard things, we communicate without realizing it.
My name is Mike Hawkins of the Kingdom Builders Ministry, and I want to echo what Rob said at the beginning. I'm just getting started with this and have a ton to learn. But I want to encourage everybody here, as I've been encouraged in the last couple of years, that small steps taken in faithfulness, that God has blessed in ways that I couldn't even have imagined at the beginning, and that God delights to use us as unlikely as that seems to us at times that he could and would and wants to. He does, and as weak as we are, that he's glorified in that.
My name is Wayne Chapman. I'm with Light Ministries, and I like to, kind of a rookie at this myself, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to be able to share. And one thing I always think about is, sometimes I get caught up in what I'm doing and to always go back to the very beginning of God's great love, which is a great motivator and, seems to accomplish what we're really trying to accomplish.
I'm Eileen Barclay. I'm the director of Light Ministries. And I just want to share that the best part about dying is being brought back to life. And I think if we die to ourselves and lay down our lives like Jesus did, it's really exciting. And we can just look at each other and say, wow, I remember where you were and where you are now. And so I just want to encourage us to cry out to Jesus and not just look for the best way to do it, but instead the best way to yell out help.
Thank you all for being here, and let's as a group thank these wonderful folks for spending their time with us. Okay, we're winding down, so what we're going to do is we're going to ask our leadership worship team to come on up. And we're going to have final remarks and ministry story and final remarks. And again, as they come up, I want to encourage you to, as I said, again, do your evaluations.